Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This is the second episode of 2016, and I am still your trusty host, Neil Horowitz. You can always find more information on the podcast and more content at dsmsports.net. And please follow me on Twitter. Hit me back with any feedback at njh287. Got a pretty interesting show for you guys today. Really excited about our conversation. We talked to Bill Johnson. He is a senior vice president and design principal with HOK. You may have heard of them. They are a well-known, well-respected architecture firm, especially specializing in sports and entertainment venues. Bill and I talk a lot about some of their past projects, and right now they are currently working on the new Mercedes-Benz named venue that the Atlanta Falcons will begin playing in before long. But before we get to our conversation with Bill, all about how venues are being changed and improved and optimized for a new digital and social world, we have this episode's helpful tool. And this episode's helpful tool goes right along with sort of the theme of the podcast, and that is an app and website that you may have heard of called Speedtest. You can access it by speedtest.com or just download the free app, and it is one of the most easiest, intuitive, and really helpful tools that you can get out there. You just push a quick start button, and before you know it, within seconds, you have an upload speed and a download speed for whatever internet connection you are on. It's a great way to test out your own internet connection and at your home or office, but really for the digital and social media sports pro, it's a great way to gauge how fast and how effective the connection is at any given venue, whether it's your home venue or one you travel to away, or even at a community or team-related event out in the city somewhere. Why does it matter? Well, first off, for upload speed, that's going to affect how easy it is, how simple and quick it is for you to upload your content. For example, if you're uploading a Vine, doing a Snap, putting a video on Twitter, putting a video on YouTube, uploading something to Facebook, the faster the upload speed is, the more effective you'll be able to be and the quicker you'll be able to get content out there. So your Vine, after a big goal is scored or a big home run or something along those lines, doesn't go out 5 minutes later, but it goes out right in time. Then the download speed, that's going to affect, of course, your downloading. Are fans trying to download replays? Are you pushing an app for them to download? All this is going to affect their ability to download those things, their ability to do what you want them to do, and ultimately enjoy their experience. At the end of the day, we're seeing more upload happening at venues overall. Of course, data is growing significantly. The Super Bowl coming up in a couple weeks here in February, we should see 6 terabytes or more probably worth of data used by the crowd at Levi's Stadium. It'll be quite interesting to see how it goes down at Santa Clara. But really, the upload is most important to the fans because they're trying to share things. Unless your venue is equipped with a bunch of replay videos and you're really trying to promote that, really the value for fans is being able to post on Instagram, put their snaps out there, or post something on Kick or Facebook or Twitter. And that's going to be affected by the upload speed, whether they're uploading a video, the latest selfie, or whatever the case may be. And that's going to really go back to their experience. So what can you do? Test your speed. Test it at all the venues. See if it improves or does not improve over time. You can affect it, obviously, by making improvements. And even better, the speed test app keeps track of all your previous tests, so you can look at venues around your school or your community. You can look at your venue compared to opposing team venues or other places in the community, and it really is a good way to sort of gauge where you stand and which venues are better for certain activities than others. So, long story short, check it out, Speed Test. It's a website and also a free handy app, and see how fast your upload and download speeds are today. All right, that's this episode's helpful tool. We'll be coming right back to have a really good conversation with Bill Johnson of HOK. All right, that was this episode's helpful tool. But we are here today with a great guest, going to have a really cool conversation looking at a different side of sort of the sports business, looking at the venue where all the action happens and really where you're trying to get fans to go there these days, not just for the games, but really for the entire experience. We are joined today by Bill Johnson, Senior Vice President and Design Principal at HOK. Welcome to the podcast, Bill.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure having you on, and I look forward to talking with you about sport venues, entertainment venues, how they're changing, how you guys are really at HOK are at the forefront of pioneering some of those changes. But before we get into our discussion today, we'd like to get to know our guests. You know, you have a pretty cool job. You've been in the game a long time. So give us an idea of your career path, how you got into what you're doing now, and any tips along the way for folks that want to be the next Bill Johnson.
Well, sure. So I graduated with a 5-year degree from the University of Kansas, go Jayhawks. So have been in the Midwest and practicing architecture in Kansas City. Kansas City was always a great place to be because we could really reach both coasts from a central location, and most of our work was out of town. So it was a great place to put down roots and establish a sports practice. I've really enjoyed getting to know the kind of people that you work with in this business, and it goes from the collegiate side and athletic directors and facilities people at universities to NFL owners and Major League Baseball owners, and it's just been, I got to say, it's been a wild ride. But I didn't really look to...
Let's jump back for a second, but when you were studying at KU, did you know you wanted to be in this space of sports entertainment venues, or was there really no such thing as that kind of specialization then?
Well, the specialization existed. I had no inclination to be a sports guy. As a matter of fact, I'm... fairly inept when it comes to athletic ability. So it was not something that was really on my radar. What happened was, is I graduated and found myself in a city that really was the birthplace of sports facilities design. Two big firms were doing sports facilities work at that time. I started at a firm called HNTB, which is really pretty much more of an engineering firm now. And at that time, the old HOK was just starting as a specialization in sports facilities design. And through a series of events and moves and changes, I had an opportunity to become a leader, a design leader, and start on sports facilities work. So it really, I kind of fell in my lap a little bit, but it was a great. And I've never looked back, and I've loved it, and I'm a huge sports fan now because I not only understand what happens on the field, but I understand the business and what it takes to actually make things happen in the business, so to speak.
Is it a significant difference, or I don't want to say step up, but a really unique set of skills and experience to be able to design these kinds of mammoth venues as opposed to just your tract housing or your office buildings?
Well, there's two things that really make this type of specialization unique. I think it can be intimidating to have a blank piece of paper and realize that you're going to be building something as large as these venues typically are. And when I'm talking large, maybe 80,000 seats for a professional football stadium, in the 40,000 seat range for a Major League Baseball park, but also, arenas in the 15 to 19,000 seat capacity. So yes, that is a overwhelming task for some people to really put a pen to a blank piece of paper. The other thing that's different about it, though, is that as a young guy, you got to be really patient about getting these things built, because the cycle of from when you start design to when you actually get a shovel in the ground and get something built can be anywhere from 4 to 6 years. If you're an impatient guy and you want to get out of school and you want to go out there and see something that you designed get built, it's probably not for you unless you can you can supplement that with some smaller jobs along the way.
That makes perfect sense. I guess then, using the fact that you have really grown up in this field and it sounds like got that specialization early on, has it changed significantly over the years? I mean, we look at some of sports and entertainment architecture. I mean, oftentimes it's not that different from the Roman Colosseum, but in other ways it's changed incredibly significantly, especially in the past maybe decade here. So what's been your sort of high-level view of how the space has evolved in your career?
Well, it's interesting you go back to history and ancient history, because, yes, we did have venues that had to accommodate large crowds to watch all sorts of public events. and the fundamental need to get people in and out of those buildings and provide a line of sight that's a quality experience, those things really haven't changed that much. But there's a series of things that changed from the time when anybody could take on a project. You know, they'd look at a sports venue as more of a civic building instead of a team-focused or a team-driven building. I think back in those days, we had very basic levels of services and levels of finish, and they were very utilitarian structures. When architects started to specialize in sports facilities design, they started to become a little bit more quality-driven and creative. And the next step, if you will, was when we realized that there was a premium that could be generated by two things, by what we would call a premium seat experience or offering, and by a sponsorship opportunity. And when those two things started to insert themselves into the business of sports facilities design, you saw some really rapid change and some really revolutionary things happen in the buildings. I mean, first of all, they got bigger. Because we put layers of suites and club seats in the middle, right? And then they started to become commercial. So we had to find ways to put advertising and graphics and sponsorship in the buildings. So those are two big, in my career anyway, turning points in the evolution of how we design the buildings.
So it's almost like the focus became a little bit shifted from let's provide the best place to watch a game versus let's provide the best way to drive the bottom line revenue overall. That includes, of course, fans coming back game after game, so a good experience for them, but also building in these ways to drive revenue through luxury suites, through sponsorships, and that became more the bottom line for you guys and for the owners as well, I guess.
It's a real circular conversation, because what happens is the reason you need that revenue stream is to afford the good quality players to put the product on the field to get the fans to buy the seats, that in turn fuels the engine that perpetuates the salaries of the players, and on and on. So it wasn't really a pocket lining scheme by the owners. It was really the pressures associated with being competitive to go after the best possible team.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Well, let's jump into sort of how these changes have come about. I mean, has it really been on you guys as the creatives, as the designers, to come up with these ways to drive revenue, to help these stadiums and venues evolve in an advantageous, beneficial way? Or has it been more the other side, where they're coming to you and saying, we want to do this, this, and this, make it happen?
A couple of things. We have always, I guess in my career, I've always felt like it was incumbent upon us to come up with a new offering. We always said, you know, let's try to do one unique thing in this building, because we don't want to just see the position of architecture in sports be stagnant, you know, just the same thing over and over in every city. So we always said, let's come up with something unique or special that we can really provide a new offering out there. And that keeps things fresh and new. And that really propelled a lot of the building wave that we had, because, you know, one owner would see, oh, wow, he did a row of suites, and those are super cool, and, oh, but then the next guy, well, he put, you know, five rows of club seats in front of that, and they share a concourse. Well, we never thought of that. And then the next person said, well, why not have two layers of suites in two different places, and then we have two different price points? And so it went on and on. And I really think that what you saw was a real, the other interesting thing just to mention is that when we were starting this, when I was a much younger guy, back 20 years ago, you know, everyone that I worked with, my friends and others that were doing other kinds of buildings, said, yo, you guys, you know, you're kind of rock stars. You fly around on airplanes and you have these fancy dinners and you do all this work for all these high-power sports people, but you guys are riding a crest of a wave, man. This is all, you're going to build all these things once, and then you're going to be done, and there'll be nothing to come. And it was because everybody was leapfrogging over each other to do the next new thing, the next best venue.
The arms race, so to speak.
Exactly. But the exact opposite has happened, because now we're actually renovating buildings that I did when I was doing them the first time. And in some cases, they're tearing down buildings that I built and replacing them with completely new buildings. So the arms race continues, my friend. And we never really thought we were on a crest of a wave, because fan expectations and really the economic drivers for the business continue to change and evolve over time.
Okay. Has it been more, when you talk about an arms race, I mean, obviously, if you are the Pittsburgh Steelers and the San Diego Chargers, well, maybe the San Diego Chargers is a bad example now, but let's say the Arizona Cardinals, you're not necessarily competing for the same fans to come to your building. So is it more about like one-upping what your current venue has, your previous venue has, or really being, you know, having the biggest jumbotron in the entire country like Jerry Jones wants to have? Is it really just, you know, being the top of the heap, so to speak?
I think that the value that you were just referring to in terms of biggest and best is really more an issue for sponsorship value. I mean, those things tend to sell on the sponsor side of the ledger. On the fan side of the ledger, I think the competing factors of different sports teams in the same market, mm-hmm. and pro versus college teams in the same market. So if you are paying, you know, $1,000 for a seat at the football stadium, and you go over to the baseball stadium and they're going to charge you $1,000 for a similar quality seat, but you don't have any of the same amenities, then someone's going to say, hey, what the heck's going on here?
Interesting.
The other thing that happens is, in some cases, there's only so many corporations and only so much corporate money behind, or so much money corporations have to spend on entertainment and business development type things in sports venues. So they may be able to afford one suite for football, but they might not be able to afford a suite in football and baseball. Or they might decide, hey, I like the club seats at baseball better, so I'm going to get the club seats there in the football stadium. I like the suite better. So all those things contribute to what the market will bear, and the buildings then have to adjust to that.
No, that certainly makes sense. You're having to win over the fans among all their different options out there, and of course you're also having to win over the sponsors, not just in the region, but really in the sport and all over the country. So it's certainly a big priority for you guys. And it sounds like you've in addition to being a talented architect, you're also become a little bit of a sports business expert, or at least you had to a little bit.
Well, you know, I appreciate the compliment. It's interesting because I think that when they hire advisors, when any team owner or franchise hires someone like us, like HOK, they really do expect us to provide the benefit of years of understanding the industry. You know, it's so funny. I had a buddy of mine that I grew up with and went to college with, and he was a business major, and he said he couldn't believe, you know, the most unathletic person he knew is like working with all these really famous, you know, sports figures. And he's like, how can you even go in a meeting? You can't even talk to these guys about the team roster or the quarterback or the catcher. I was like, that's the last thing they want to hear from me. They don't want to hear about, you know, I'm not a rabid fan that wants an autograph. I have to understand the business model, and I have to understand what they're going to need to do to be competitive. And they see us in a very different light. I mean, we're sports fans because we love it, but that's not the kind of advice they look for. They really look for a sort of a business savvy about the industry in general.
Oh, I love that. Having a great conversation on the podcast right now with Bill Johnson, Senior Vice President and Design Principal and part-time sports business guru at HOK Architectural Firm. And Bill, I guess let's segue off of that. And when it does come to you guys providing that counsel, that kind of support, where is the evolution really happening the most significantly, most rapidly right now? I mean, we talk about Wi-Fi, we talk about digital signage, even community spaces instead of the individual seats, fantasy lounges. I mean, where do you see the most innovation happening most quickly, most significantly right now?
Well, I think the innovation arrow is pointed towards technology. And what we have found, and I just use an example of the NFL, and this is fairly fairly known, but, you know, I talked to Arthur Blank at length about this, the owner of the Falcons, and we're doing, you know, the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium for him in Atlanta right now. When we started that project, I mean, he made the blanket statement that the biggest challenge facing the NFL is getting the fans to come back out to the venues and buy the tickets and fill the stadium. And the reason is because the NFL, like other major sports and even college sports, have done such a great job of creating digital and electronic content and made it so accessible that it disincents people from getting up out of their living room or their man cave where they can watch four or five games at the same time, you know, have the red zone, have fantasy sports all at their fingertips, and go out in the cold and buy an expensive parking ticket, do a tailgate environment, buy expensive seats, buy expensive food, and spend the entire day out at the stadium. So what they then come to us and say is, okay, Bill, you have to come up with some spectacular venue that is going to convince everybody that they have to come out and see this game, because the only way they're going to really truly experience it is by being there. And that's a tall order for an architect and a tall order for a stadium or a ballpark.
No pressure for HOK, huh?
No kidding. I mean, you know, so we have to talk about the pregame experience, the postgame experience. We have to talk about connectivity. We're talking about special game feeds that only are accessible from the stadium. In the case of the video board in Atlanta, it's a 360-degree display in the round, 60 feet tall. It's the largest scoreboard in the world,
wow,
right? And it is meant to provide a program content that is experiential and that you can see really the game happening in three dimensions or all around you, surrounding you. And you can't get that on a flat screen at home. So, but the technology is there, but the programmers don't even quite know how to really fully exploit it. So then, if you look at all of the stadium proposals for this whole NFL move to California, every single one of those copied the Halo board in Atlanta. So, and those are all conceptual designs. So I think what you're seeing is, you know, the arms race has now shifted to technology and the experience of going to a venue and going and experience in the game in person. So that's the biggest challenge we have right now.
And how does that work from an HOK perspective? When you guys are designing these buildings now, are you interfacing pretty frequently with the IT department, talking about what they're going to do with their mobile app? Is HOK even thinking about, you know, having a partner in that space or some in-house specialist to help advise on those things?
We are actually in a partnership with IBM, an exclusive partnership. We're the architectural partner. They're providing what's called a PON system. It's PON, but what it basically is a fiber optic network, and it has the carrying capacity that is really going to exponentially create a much better experience for technology and venues. And so we're on the bleeding edge of that with IBM as our partner, which is pretty cool. The interesting thing about technology, though, is that if you really look at the research, which we have, and you start pulling what millennials and really the next generation are going to anticipate 10, 15 years out from now, which is really where we have to be targeting. You know, these buildings could take 7 years to build, as we said, so you've got to be looking that far out. My sense is that the pendulum is going to swing the other way. And what we're seeing is that, especially in teens, is that they really want to disconnect, if you can believe that.
Right.
Because if you go out to a venue now and look down a row, all you see is people on their phones. But there's going to be, I think there's going to be a point when people are going to want to disconnect and be at the game for the game and not for the social media aspect of being in the crowd. So, you know, the cautionary note here is, are we going to really overbuild the technology side of things and really miss the mark on this? So, you know, you got to proceed with caution, but it's kind of a crystal ball too. You don't really know what is ultimately going to be the next new thing.
So are you guys really then designing with the idea of, let's try to make this as timeless as possible so it can evolve the way that culture evolves, or is it more, let's make this as fungible as possible. So when it comes time that some evolution takes place, we know we can, you know, renovate pretty easily.
We're huge advocates of flexible planning and flexible space. The last few venues that we've worked on, we've done everything from demountable walls and partitions and clubs and suites to consolidating the plumbing and the fixtures and the services in ways that really provide the ability to reconfigure the seat side, if you will, of the field side of venues, because we don't really ultimately know. I mean, 3 years, people might be all about loge boxes and club seats. The next 3 years, people might want consolidated suites or party suites. The trend is, though, is that people do not necessarily favor suites the way they did. People are not going, you think about it, you know, all we're talking about in this conversation is creating a social environment where you can all go and be with people and see people and see a game. Okay. It's a little counterintuitive to suggest that people are going to want to go into a 15-foot wide box and shut the door once you get them out there. So really, I think that we're going to see a lot fewer suites, or suites that are reconfigurable or maybe have flexible seating within them. And I think that you're going to see that trend. But that said, I think that our job is to be sure that if that happens, we can accommodate it without tearing the whole thing down and starting over.
Oh, certainly. Let's jump quickly then. Even whether fans are connected or not, I think one thing that we can be certain is going to be here in the future is just the preponderance of data, whether it's passive or not, whether it's just, you know, tracking fan activity through beacon technology and fan traffic, IBM heat maps and whatnot. How much do you guys take into account data, or even when you're planning or renovating, of, you know, looking at here's the entrance that fans are using the most, or here's where the traffic is flowing right now, and here's how we want to manipulate it so that fans are going to the team store more often, to the sponsor booth more often?
Well, it's a huge challenge, but it's a great opportunity. And I think we're talking, you will already start to see some of this happening, certainly in Atlanta, and most of the new venues, I would think, that would be in the planning phase, is that we want to drive digital information to the fans from the minute they get in their car on the way to the venue. We want to be able to tell fans what exit to take, what gate is backed up. We want to be able to redirect them to a better security line. We want to welcome them with personal messages once they enter the venue. And by doing that, we can really track and monitor not only their use, but where they go, what they buy, how long they stay. And then that information can be used to customize a better fan package for the next season. So it is, you know, all over, you know, the opportunities. It's a little Big Brother-like, but the real value is to be able to know your fan base better and be able to streamline the means by which they get from their home to their seat and back again, and really offer them a customized, unique, personal experience when they come to the venue.
Is that data being used at all, whether, you know, you may not have enough right now, but when you guys are going into designing a new building or renovating a new building like you did with Atlanta, building a new one there, are you guys looking at that, at any sort of data to help inform the design, or even talking to the Falcons and Arthur Blank about what route do you want fans to take? How do you want them to get to their seat? Or is it more after the fact of let's start analyzing after we build the venue what's working, what's not working, what we can adjust sort of on the fly?
Neil, I'm afraid that's classified information, and I won't be able to answer that.
Hey, no worries at all. If it's classified information, then I'm asking the right questions then.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. The answer is that I don't know, honestly. We are not collecting and tracking data from a research point of view as a company.
Right.
The teams and their ability to interact with their fan base in terms of ticket sales and in terms of connectivity is really, I don't know that that's something that, I think every team might have their own approach to that. And I'm sure they're tracking and monitoring it. I'm sure it has to do with ticket sales and fan surveys, but I really don't know enough to tell you on how much of that's actually being implemented or not.
Okay, well, let's shift then briefly, especially it's very relevant right now, and I'm glad we're talking today with the recent NFL to LA news, and they're talking about building that new venue in Inglewood and really imagining it not just for football, but for all sorts of events to make money year-round. And that really seems to be the consideration now is let's just not build a venue just for sports, but that we can make money off of 24/7, 365. So does that change how you guys go about designing? Is it really is there a big difference between a football stadium and a mixed-use venue, or is it really becoming one and the same nowadays?
These buildings have to have multiple events to cash flow and to really be profitable. Most of the planning around the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta, for example, had to do with location. It's adjacent to the Georgia World Congress Center, which is one of the biggest convention venues in the country. Arthur Blank has purchased an expansion Major League Soccer team. It's playing. They have the SEC. They have the Final Four. They have a potential bid for the Super Bowl. So, you know, when people say that, oh, yeah, this is a multi-purpose building, I think the thing that is interesting about it is that there are certain things you have to do to make that happen. I mean, for example, you have to have a roof. For soccer, you have to have a retractable roof because FIFA events need to be played out of doors. For the Final Four, you have to have the ability to have a scoreboard and a sealable roof so that people don't get wet. I mean, so it determines certain design features that a venue would have. Mm-hmm. But most buildings, if they can afford or they are in the right location to support multiple varied events, will pursue that. Just makes sense.
Is it easier or harder probably not easier, but a lot different to design a venue that's going to be situated in, say, you know, Charlotte, North Carolina versus New York, New York, where you have to deal with, you know, the nor'easters and snowstorms, whereas, you know, down south you may not have to as much. Is that a really huge component of what goes into the design?
Well, you know, I think that each environment, you know, playing football in Green Bay is not playing football in Arizona, you know. So I think fans and football teams and franchises start to identify with the uniqueness of where they play, you know. A cold environment or a high altitude in Denver becomes what we call maybe a home field advantage. Mm-hmm. As for the architecture, I don't think that it really is that big of a factor. I mean, you know, certain areas we have to deal with earthquake loads or high winds, and certain areas we have to deal with unstable ground. But really, at the end of the day, it's pretty much on the discretion of the team and whether they want to be outdoors or indoors or multi-purpose, open end zones. I mean, those are things that are almost a little bit subjective in certain ways.
And how about just the last few things here before we get to this episode's shareable stat, talking to Bill Johnson, Senior Vice President, Design Principal at HOK. Give me a quick idea about making it feel like it's local, making it feel like it's native to the area. And that, it feels like maybe that started out becoming a trend maybe in the late 90s of really, let's not just build the most magnificent looking building, but let's build a building that really looks like it belongs here in this state, in this city, in this area, this region.
Good question. Here's my take on this. I think that there was a time when buildings were backward looking and nostalgic, and they wanted to, especially Major League Baseball, I think more so than anything, really wanted to focus on the history. A lot of places had very unique built environments, be them brick or limestone or whatever. And I think that there was a time when those buildings were trying to be part of that urban fabric. I think we're in more of a visionary time now when buildings are looking to the future. I think the European market and to a certain extent the Asian market got out in front and wanted to do much more contemporary architecture. And I'm a big advocate of that because I believe that as much history as you have around a ballpark or a team or a franchise, I think that, you know, that looking forward is always better than looking back. And technology and, you know, construction techniques and the things that we have at our disposal, new materials, those things don't seem very sincere or honest when you put them in an old wrapper. So to a certain degree, I think that you're going to see more contemporary venues. But what I will tell you is changing is this notion of the haves and the have-nots. I think what you're going to start to see, especially when we go into some of these older buildings and modify them, is that we're going to be providing more cool, fun hangout places for everybody, not just the people with the best seat or the best ticket. Upper decks, end zones, plazas, roof decks, things that maybe you don't see now. And these are going to be lounges where you can hang out, you can connect to the internet, you can maybe have a specialty drink, maybe there's an opportunity for autographs, or maybe there's a connection with the players themselves. And what we're going to do is see these venues start to downsize their capacities and create more of these types of every fan or every man, every fan kind of zones. And I think that's going to be super great for everybody. Because really, at the end of the day, that's what we've got to do. We've got to reconnect not just the fans that are spending the most or the corporations that are buying all the expensive suites and club seats, but we've got to get the people in the upper deck fired up about coming back out to the venues, and we've got to provide places where they feel special too. And so that's really high on our list at HOK. That's something that we're really an advocate of when we go out and meet with the owners and the franchises.
That's fantastic. I love that. I can picture it almost like it's like going to a party, but there's a game going on the field that you can check in every now and then. It's a great communal experience, and it sounds like you guys have a vision for how the fan experience can evolve in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years now. That's awesome. Well, before we get to Central Charitable Stat, one last thing for you. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this because it's kind of interesting to me. Is how do you go about getting a project like the Atlanta Falcons? I mean, is Arthur Blank or his firm literally just putting out some RFPs to some of the big, most respectable names out there? Are you guys looking for opportunities? I mean, how does a project like that even come together from prospecting to signing to start and finish?
It varies quite a bit, but generally speaking, there is a number of firms that really are established in this specialization. So we tend to compete with the same people over and over. I do think you see some people want to go out and dip their toe in the well and see if they can find some really out there design firm that would maybe put a different spin on the building types. But more often than not, all of those things come back to firms like ours because they just need the expertise of getting the seats right, getting the sight lines right. The interview process is pretty painful, to be quite frankly. We end up having to compete. A lot of times we'll do models, drawings, renderings, even animations to convey our point of view. In some cases, they'll want to just see how we think and give us some ideas. But in other cases, like in the case of Atlanta, we came in with a full-blown scheme, and Arthur Blank fell in love with it. And it had a model that was the size of a 3-foot by 4-foot model with a button that opened the roof. So that was a lot of work, and it was a big crapshoot to go out and put your ideas out there. But it's very competitive. It's not for the faint of heart. We end up losing and winning, but when you win, there's nothing like it. It's really great.
I love that. I hope Mr. Blank has that little copy of the model on his desk every day. It'd be a great collector's item, I'm sure. And it's really cool the fact that you guys are not just designing buildings, but really when you step back and look at it, you guys are playing an integral role in how the space is evolving in sports business and fan experience. And I could pick your brain about this stuff all day, Bill. And it's been really interesting hearing from you. But we're gonna have a little more fun with you momentarily. We're going to be right back with this episode of Charitable Stat, and then we're going to have our Behind Bill segment, more with Bill Johnson, SVP and Design Principal at HOK.
Really enjoyed the conversation with Bill. Really interesting to hear, really from a designer himself, an architect himself, who's helping to really design the venues of the future about where sports and entertainment venues are going. And we're going to get to know Bill a little bit more, have a little fun with him in our Behind Bill segment coming right up. But first, we have this episode's Shareable Stat. This episode of Shareable Stack goes right along with what we're talking about on today's podcast, and that is looking back at college football attendance in the 2015 season that just passed. And it was down less than 1% from last year in 2014, but down significantly since it hit its peak in 2008. So the shareable stat for today is 43,288. That is the average number of fans per game for FBS schools in the 2015 college football season. 43,288. Not bad, all things considered, when you look at the number of fans that, you know, an NBA team or NHL team or MLB is driving on a per game basis. But it's significantly down. It's a trend that college football and schools all over the country at the FBS level are worried about, and something that's certainly on the mind of folks like Bill Johnson at HOK. What are they doing to combat that? Well, you heard it from Bill in our earlier interview, and of course you've seen plenty of articles probably that first and foremost it's connectivity and giving fans that Wi-Fi, that connection, that ability to peruse fantasy stats, social media, even email and texting without any issue at all is now a new expectation for fans. If it's not there, it's simply not acceptable, and they're just going to stay home and watch their flat screen 4K HDs and whatnot. But what else are they doing to improve the experience? Well, you heard it from Bill too, and that's really creating just that, a true experience at the game. It's not just about going and watching the guys on the field. Yes, that's still a part of it. That's still the main attraction. But it's also about going to a party almost. You know, being there with a community, with a group. Like you're at an exciting club or a concert. Just like that same thing. There's these communal areas you're hearing about that Bill is discussing at the venue venues that they're creating, as well as others popping up around the country, and really making it seem like a good time, a true event that you're going to, and not just a ticket to get into a game. More stuff going on than just the game on the field. Exciting sponsor activations. You know, virtual reality on-site activations are becoming a new thing, especially in the NFL and starting up now in the NHL and the NBA as well. So really keep an eye on all the other stuff they're doing at stadiums and venues to improve the experience and make it a can't-miss event, something that you truly have to be there to experience. Whether it's, you know, high-fiving tons of people you don't know and almost recreating that sports bar experience, except that the game is happening right there in front of you. Creating more of a family-style experience when it comes to food and beverages, and not just waiting in line for the old hot dog to stick some ketchup on and then get a beer for $8. It's really creating something you can experience with friends, with family, an event that you really cannot recreate even in the most comfortable, most digitally impressive living rooms of the world. So that's this episode's Shareable Stat. Think about it. Think about what is being done to combat it. The fact that even though there were 43,288 fans attending FBS home games in college football in 2015, it's a downward trend that certainly bears watching. All right, that's this episode's Shareable Stat. It comes courtesy of CBSSports.com. Thanks to John Solomon. He always writes a lot of good articles about that topic. And we'll be coming right back at you. Have a little more fun with Bill Johnson of HOK in our Behind Bill segment.
All right, that was this episode's Shareable Stat, and now we're right back with Bill Johnson, Senior Vice President and Design Principal at HOK, architectural firm that, among other things, specializes in sports entertainment venues. And we had a great conversation with Bill, and now he survived his interview, and it's time for the Behind Bill segment. Are you ready, Bill?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's do it. Okay, this one's a bit of a loaded question, but keep your answer brief. How has social interaction and fan engagement really becoming part of the conversation between HOK and your prospective clients?
So the social interaction, we spend an enormous amount of time talking about this because I do think that there is, I mean, to go back to what we talked about earlier, is that there is this real desire and need to reach out and anticipate what younger fans are going to want to do. Now, the interesting thing is younger fans a lot of times aren't in the most expensive zones of the building. Sometimes they're in the cheap seats, right, or in the end zone or in the outfield or whatever. And so the social media and how to enhance the game experience for them and how the building can actually become part of that interactive experience is a really big deal, and I think a huge opportunity for the future, because, you know, you'll go into a Wi-Fi environment in a building, and the building will start actually talking to you and interacting with you depending on where you are, what you're doing, all of those things. So to me, it's a big deal, and yes, teams are very focused on it.
It's great to know that the focus is no longer on how can we get butts in seats, but how can we get fans to the venue and then give them an experience that'll keep them coming back and fans for life. All right, number
Absolutely.
Two for you, Bill. This is what I'm looking forward to. The most memorable design project of your entire career, and why?
Well, it's hard to not say that the last one you did is the most important one, because it's a culmination of all of your experience along the way. And if I had to answer truthfully, I would say that what's happening down in Atlanta with Mercedes-Benz Stadium, I believe, is going to reset the industry, because there is not one aspect of that building that is not challenging every football stadium that has been built before it, from the roof, from the technology, from the, you know, even the ETFE clear skin membrane that we're putting on the outside, to the urban planning. It's most probably going to be at the highest level of LEED certification, which is unprecedented. No building has had that in the past, and because the way it is scored environmentally, it will probably never happen again. And Arthur Blank is the most amazing owner and just a great personal friend and somebody I really admire. So I would have to say that.
That's awesome.
There's maybe one other interesting experience. When I worked on the Gund Arena for the Cleveland Cavaliers, and we were in the design process, at the time Gordon Gund was the owner, and he was blind. And he wanted to take part in the design of the building, so we actually built models that he could feel with his fingers, and we had to go through the plans, holding his hand and guiding him through that process. And to me, personally, that was a very moving and kind of a wonderful experience for me. So there's a couple.
That's incredible. And maybe the answer is a definite yes, but are you going to be there for that first game at the new Atlanta venue when it happens?
If Arthur and I are still friends, we are. But yes, absolutely. I wouldn't miss it for anything.
Oh, I can't wait. I know you got to be patient in your role, but I'm sure you're anxious for that to happen too. All right, number three for you, Bill. This might be a tough one, so maybe just one of your favorites. Your favorite venue in which to watch a sports game?
Wow. That one is a tough one. And if I was really impartial, I've just got to say the last two great experiences I've had is watching the Royals in Kauffman Stadium, and then I actually was at Game 5 at Citi Field in New York to watch him capture the World Series. So, I mean, that's just stuck in my mind. So I'd have to say that was an amazing experience.
Oh,
maybe more about the game than the building, but it was still pretty cool.
Certainly. And when it all comes together, that's the ideal. Is that when the game is really driving a lot of that emotion, that experience, is the venue ready to maximize on it? All right, number four for you, Bill. I guess here, when you guys do sign with a client, we kind of went through this a little bit before, but how does it work, and what's the timeline like from signing a new customer, figuring out a design, putting you know the stake in the ground, so to speak, and starting construction to finally getting it up? I mean, what's that process like, and how long does it all take?
Well, it is always varies depending on the size and the scope of the project. We design can take as long as a year. Construction can take as long as 3 years. There's ways that you can compress that depending on the size of the venue, depending if you have a clean site, if you have to do utility relocation or any kind of mitigation, all those things can slow you down. So it's a hard question to answer, but I would say, you know, be prepared for a long wait. And the pressure point for the industry is actually owners. You know, once the deal is done and cut and once the contracts are signed, it's go, go, go. And that is not always the best way to do a big, complicated construction project. And we always counsel against trying to get in a year early, but it always seems like there's that pressure to try to compress the schedule and get there sooner.
Most certainly. They're spending enough money. They want these buildings to be valuable for years on end. So you got to make sure you take your time and do it the right way, for sure. All right, number five for you, Bill. This one I'm excited to hear. So you went to Kansas. I'm sure you're a huge Jayhawks fan, even though they lost last night. Tell me the number one reason why Allen Fieldhouse is just one of the best places to watch a basketball game in college sports.
Well, you know, I don't know if you saw Dick Vitale call the game between Kansas and Oklahoma, which maybe is one of the will be one of the best basketball games ever.
Totally.
You know, his comment was it was the loudest event that he had ever attended. And that building is a big barn with a lot of hard surfaces and a lot of crazy fans. And I tell you what, you feel it's a unique experience, man. It's just something like it's hard to describe because I think the size of it, you know, it's not quite as small as some of the other old venues that people talk a lot about, but it has this history and this resonance and just it's like being inside a drum. And that's the only way I can really describe it. And the fans, you know, they're the best. They know they're watching every aspect of the basketball game and they know what's going on and they are so locked in to what's going on the court. It's just an amazing experience.
Rock Chalk Jayhawk. Well, let's stay right on that then. How about it can be from when you were going there as a student or any memory you want. What is your favorite Kansas University sports memory?
Well, it was after I graduated, and I can't remember the year, but it was the year that it was the 50th anniversary of the NCAA. The Final Four was being played in Kansas City, and it was against Oklahoma and Kansas. And at halftime, the game was tied 50-50. And I'll never forget that because it was just all these layers of 50, you know, on top of each other. And it was just an amazing experience.
That's fantastic. And obviously a fun game, too, because there was 50 points on each team's side at halftime. That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, number seven for you. Let's talk about, especially with the upcoming Atlanta venue, what's going to be the one piece of innovation in that venue that really is going to, the industry is going to be wowed about, that we're going to be talking about?
Well, on the Atlanta Stadium, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, I don't know if the subtlety of this will resonate with everybody, but that building was designed as a completely integrated idea. So the roof and the seats and the skin and the scoreboard and all of those things were part of one big idea, and we wanted to make a beautiful, iconic structure for Arthur and for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. And we didn't want to put a bunch of seats under a box or a gantry crane and just have a really disorganized design, which I think a lot of the new football venues really are not very well integrated in how they look and how they work. So, but I think that the big wow moments will definitely be the scoreboard. It's certainly how the roof opens and just its presence on the skyline, I think, is going to be really extraordinary. I think people will actually go to see that structure for the structure and not just to go see some event there.
I will add it to my list of landmarks to see when I make it down to Atlanta one of these days to visit. That's great. All right, number eight for you. This is always a fun topic. The sports venue with the best food and what you get there.
Wow. You know what? I hate to say this, but I'm still looking. It's, you know, it's interesting because I'm trying to think of one that really stands out. I don't know if I can answer that. I don't know if there's nothing that I would say that I would go there just because I had to have some local or, you know, regional piece of food. So
will the venues of the future have like full service restaurants? Are we going to get more sophisticated there? Will the concession stand not change too much, too dramatically over the years?
Well, I think one thing you're going to see is that, and one of the things that the Falcons are talking about is really creating almost street pricing for food and concessions, where a family can go and get a bucket of chicken, for example, and, you know, more picnic style instead of everything being so individualized. And that's just that's a thought about doing better quality food, but doing it in a way that is more affordable and maybe would encourage you to take, you know, a family with two or three kids out to a football game as a family. That's important, you know, and I think, you know, to me, that's maybe a bigger issue than the kind of food. It's the accessibility to food that is really well done, but also served family style or served in a way that is more affordable.
Certainly. I like that answer a lot. All right, the last one for you, Bill. On your bucket list, what is the one sports event that you most like to attend that you haven't been able to yet?
Ooh. Well, I tell you what. So I was fortunate. I actually worked on the Olympic Stadium and Turner Field for Atlanta when I was at LRB Beckett. And that was super cool because we did the stadium for the Olympics and then converted it to Turner Field. Unfortunately, they're going to be tearing Turner Field down, so I'm feeling old about that. But I got to go to the closing ceremony of the Olympics, but I did not go to the opening ceremony. So I think I would love to go to the opening ceremony for the Olympics in Japan.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, too bad he missed out on Muhammad Ali back at those games. But
absolutely.
I'm sure you'll find a way to make it to one at some point. And heck, you already saw the Royals clinch the World Series. So you're doing okay on your sports events, I think.
I can't complain.
All right, Bill, you survived your Behind Bill segment. Now it's your chance to give us your social media all-star to follow, someone, a blogger, someone on Twitter, who they are and why they're worth following.
Sports Business Nation is one that was interesting because they picked up the interview process for Atlanta, and I didn't know much about the blog, and I didn't know much about social media at the time, but because it was a public process, they picked up not only all of our negotiations, our contracts, our fees, and everything, and they just splattered it out there. It was unbelievable. But they also put this, they do some great writing. There were some really funny comments about the design and the shape of it and what people were comparing it to things, but it got a lot of buzz. So that one I really enjoy. But, you know, typically I like looking at, you know, ESPN. I follow NASCAR. I follow some of the peripheral sports that maybe we don't work in as much, just to sort of stay abreast and see what's up with them.
Excellent. And how about yourself? Where can we find you and all things HOK on digital and social media?
Do you know that? Is it at HOK Sports, mm-hmm. Rec, and Entertainment on Twitter? So it's and then HOK Network on Facebook and LinkedIn.
Excellent. I'll be sure to link that up. And Bill, I cannot thank you enough for your time today, sharing with us some of your experience and your expertise. And I know I, for one, will never be able to look at a sports entertainment venue the same way again now that we've had this insightful discussion. So thanks so much again for coming on the podcast today.
Well, I'm sorry for that, but thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
And I'll be looking for you at that first Falcons game. I'll be scanning the audience for you.
That sounds great.
All right,
we're looking forward to it.
Thanks again, sir.
Uh-huh.
Thank you so much again to Bill Johnson, Senior Vice President and Design Principal at HOK. Just a pleasure and a privilege to talk to him. A wealth of experience and knowledge in this space. And really, as much as you may not believe it, as an architect, helping to lead the true evolution of the venue experience and venue amenities in sports and entertainment. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Please do check out their website for other episodes and content, dsmsports.net, and hit me up on Twitter at NJH287. I'll see you next time on the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.